Sitting down today with Ross Crane, whose career began, I believe, back in 1954.
That's correct.
And Ross, how did you get involved in radio in the first place?
Well, I was interested in radio because I grew up with it. It was the major medium of entertainment in the home when I was growing up. We got our first TV set when I was 21 years old. So I listened to all the old stuff, The Shadow and The Green Hornet and the variety and comedy shows, Jack Benny, Fred Allen, and so on. And then when I got McGee High School back in the 1940s, I listened to the local disc jockeys. The late night ones were people like Vic Waters, Wilf Ray. And after school, there was a great disc jockey on CKWX. I think he came on about 4 p.m., named Rio Thompson, and he had a great show called Off the Record, where he played big band and jazz and stuff, and Jack Kyle was at CKWX in those days, and he did the Saturday Swing Show, among others that I remember. So that's really how I got interested in it. Also, in those days, I used to listen to AM stations down the coast at night. They came in here loud and clear, unlike today where you have so much static and interference that you don't hear AM much. And I suspect that's why a lot of AM stations are going dark. One of the people that I used to hear was Steve Allen. He did a local show in L.A. at the CBS radio studios. They were known as Columbia Square. They were on the corner of Sunset and Gower in Hollywood. And he did a show very much like The Tonight Show, where he went down to the audience and talked to people and would say things like, "And where do you go to school?" And they'd say, "I go to Hollywood High." And he'd say, "Where do you go when you're sober?" And hilarious things like that. You know, it was very funny to us at the time. I always thought, you know, I'd like to do something like that, get into radio. So I went to UBC after I left McGee High School and joined the Radio Society, where a lot of people who got into radio were. Ron Robinson was there then, Bruno Simili, Bob Gillies, Don Kalmakoff, who later became an engineer and was the chief engineer at CKNW for a while, and we took a course which was sponsored by the BC Association of Broadcasters. Now, it was held at CKWX in the old radio playhouse that they had on Seymour Street. We learned how to announce and also other things like sales, copywriting, and stuff like that. It was a very good course. And I became more interested in this than I was in my studies at UBC. So it happened that in 1954, John Ansel at CKWX offered me a summer job. And I said, "Oh boy, will I take that?" And I jumped at it. So I was there filling in, but working mostly evenings because the guys that went on vacation were day guys, and so the guys who were regularly on evenings filled in for them. So mostly I did evenings. We were still, and this was probably bad timing on my part, getting into radio in 1954 because television had just come into the market. In the fall of 53, I think it was December 53, CBUT went on the air. KBOS Bellingham had been on for several months before that. And you could also get the Seattle stations. You could get King and Como. And if you were in the right area and had a high enough antenna, you could pull in KTNT in Tacoma, which was the CBS affiliate. So there was television around, but not to any great extent until 1953 in this market. And then the radio stations didn't know what to do because suddenly their evening audience figures were going down the tubes. Daytime was not a problem because there wasn't much television on in the daytime then. CBUT signed on at, I think it was 5 o'clock, with a great show called Test Pattern and Music. And then they had the usual programming during the evening, which took away from radio, and the other stations that you could get in the market, the primetime programming, took away from radio. So radio stations were in a state of flux at this point. They really didn't know what to do. But we still, when I was working there in the evenings, had all big 16-inch transcriptions of the old shows like Information Please, Eddie Cantor, and some of the variety shows, some of the game shows and so on, and the mystery shows. I was an announce operator. CKWX didn't go with the operators. They figured announce operation was the way to go. And I didn't have much announcing to do. It was just station breaks in between the programs and the odd commercial. But one thing that I did, which is interesting, was I was one of the many doghouse program engineers. Bill Ward had a corny old show that was on at, I think it was 11:05 after the news until midnight. He played novelty records, really old stuff too sometimes. And he had his own sponsors that he went out and sold himself. There was a lot of that in those days. Jack Cullen, for instance, used to sell his own advertisers. He had Frank G. Ward Music Company, if you remember. No, you wouldn't remember. You're too young. But he had, and Harrison's Clothing. It's funny how all these sponsors' names stay with you. Marvelous thing about advertising. Bill Ward, anyway, had sponsors like Tien Jor Lee, the Chinese herbalist, and Seasonal Grocers, which were at the corner of Helmickan and Granville, would you believe, a grocery store right downtown. What were some of his others now? There was Granny's Market, and there was the Pied Piper Exterminators. So anyway, Bill was a great old guy, but he did tip the bottle a lot. And even while he was on the air, he often had a bottle of gin under the table that he would help himself to from time to time. And I always thought the show got better. The drunker he got, I thought, the better the show was. But one night, and I had since at that time, and I'll get back to it in a minute, had gone from being evenings, this summer job that I had been offered became a permanent, and I became the all-night man at CKWX, and I'll talk a bit more about that later. Anyway, back to Bill Ward. I was then working all night, and I was back, it was about 11:30, I guess. And I was back getting my show assembled for the all-night run. And I suddenly heard there was no more Bill. There was just music being played back-to-back. And I thought, that's odd. Don Fawcett was the program engineer at that time on Bill Ward's Doghouse. Don was from a radio family. His father owned the station in Fort Frances, Ontario. And eventually, Don went back there and took over the radio station. And he has since gone to the great radio station in the sky, as a great many of us have. But anyway, in those days, he was an announce operator at CKWX, and he happened to have the doghouse as one of the things he had to operate for. He decided that Bill was just too drunk to be on the air and cut him right off. And Don was still playing the records back-to-back and signed off. And by that time, I was into the control room, ready to do my show. Somebody else was doing the news, I think, at that point. I didn't really ask any questions, but Don had decided that Bill was too drunk to do the show. Bill was gone the next day. He took his show and all his sponsors over to CJOR, and it was stipulated at CJOR that Bill had to record the show at 10 in the morning. Anyway, that worked out all right, but back to Don Fawcett. You know what replaced Bill on the doghouse at 11:05 on CKWX, Monday through Friday? Your date with Don. Don Fawcett did his own show. Anyway, back to my being the all-night man. And there's a story behind this, too. Bob Gillies, who had been at the Radio Society with me, was offered the all-night job at CKWX. They had not been all-night before this, but the theory was, as you know, that if you stayed on the air all night, people would turn the radio off at some time, and then in the morning that same station will be on the radio, and it would help your morning audience if you were on the air all night. American Airlines had recently started a series of all-night shows on the CBS-owned and operated stations in the state. And the station that I used to listen to Steve Allen on, KNX, 1070 on the dial, I think it still is, and can be heard here, sort of. 1050 on the island, CFAX interferes with it a bit, but you can still pick it up. They decided to do something that was quite unusual and have classical music all night. So it was American Airlines Music Till Dawn. And I understand it was fairly successful. And here, there were no audience measurement figures all night, so who knows what was successful and what wasn't. CKWX John Ansel decided to copy American Airlines Music Till Dawn, and he devised a program called Concert Under the Stars, which was classical music all night. Started out with fairly light stuff, Broadway show tunes and things like that, and got deeper as the evening progressed. 3 o'clock, we'd play a symphony or an opera or something, and then lighten up again till 6 in the morning. And opposite me on CJLR was my old friend Bruno Simulai, who I'd known at the Radio Society. Bruno had gone to CKMO after he left the Radio Society and then got a job at CJLR as the all-night man. He used to phone me, I used to phone him, because we were old buddies. And I said, you know, there's a plug here on the plug board on CKWX in the control room, and it's labeled CJLR Remote Line. And he says, that's funny. I have a thing here that says CKWX. Oh, I said, well, let's try it out. So I fed something down this line. He plugged it in, and sure, there was a connection between the two stations. I think it was originally there so that we could transmit commercial material back and forth without having to bicycle discs
or tapes or anything like that.
Whatever, yeah. So we thought, how can we make this work to our advantage? And I said, I know. The CJLR music library has a lot of stuff that I don't, and so CKWX has a lot that you don't. So anything you want that you'd like, I can feed your way, and vice versa. And I had 3 turntables in the control room at the time, and could usually do the show on 1 turntable because I was playing a symphony or something which lasted an hour. On a spare turntable, I could put some music and feed it to Bruno, and he could have a bit of a break. And the same thing with me, although I don't know how he ever did it, because he just had 2 turntables in his control room. He explained it one time to Vic Waters what we were doing. Vic Waters was the program manager. Bruno says now he doesn't think Waters ever got it or understood what we were doing. And a lot of people didn't. I remember Norris McLean used to say, oh, well, you heard the same music on CJLR that you did on CKWX. Somebody else said, well, you used to do your show at CJLR even though it was transmitted. No, no, that wasn't how it worked at all. We were at our respective radio stations and played the music for the other one. And it worked out pretty well.
So the overnight show at WX, that lasted how long?
That lasted until the spring, I think it was June of 1955. CKWX was going through quite a process of reorganization, I guess one could be, is the polite word, at that point. Jack Kyle had left. Jack Kyle was one of their top personalities, and he did the make-believe ballroom, the most recent thing he had done on CKWX, which was a syndicated show. I think it originated at WNEW in New York. In Toronto, CKEY had the make-believe ballroom with Keith Sandy, and it was highly formatted and segmented. You had a big band section, a vocal group, a quarter hour of a vocal group, quarter hour of a small combo, and whatever. And it was supposedly this big ballroom with a revolving stage, where the performers all came front and center and performed. And you were supposed to simulate a ballroom. I don't think it fooled anybody, but it was a nice program. Anyway, Jack, I don't know if he got an offer from CKNW. I believe it was, because what had happened was Jack Cullen had gone back to CKMO. This was in 55. After having been at CKNW for several years, although he started at CKMO. And they had a gap there. They needed a big personality to fill Jack's shoes. So I think that's why Jack was lured away. And he, in turn, lured away Bob Hutton, who was the top morning man in the market, had been for years. CKWX never really recovered from both Kyle and Hutton leaving at that point. They couldn't get the morning ratings anymore because Hutton took all his listeners to CKNW, which already had a big audience. in the morning. And so ever after that, there was a revolving door of morning mail at CKWX. And I had nothing to do with this, but coincidentally, I went over to CJLR. And I don't know why, but I did. I was somehow lured over there, although I wasn't a big name. When I arrived at CJLR, Ross Mortimer, I found out about this later, Ross Mortimer, who was a big personality, all the big names were there, you won't remember them, but there was GG with his morning informalities, as he called it. There was Dorwin Baird, Ross Mortimer, a lot of prominent people in Vancouver radio. Anyway, Ross Mortimer got all the brass into the office and said, Ross Crane has to change his name. I'm not going to have another Ross working at this station. And Jack Short, the voice of the races, said, and he just really laughed it off and said, if that's the case, then we'll have to have a news director named Sam Webster. Jack Webster was the news director at the time. So I never did change my name. Jack Webster was a wonderful person. He was the news director at CJLR, and he had not worked in radio at this point. The policy at CJLR at that time, again, this is 1955, was to hire people who didn't necessarily have a broadcast background. Jack was one of those. He had been a reporter at The Sun, and suddenly came to CJLR. And I remember there was this big stairway. The CJLR studios were in the basement of the Grosvenor Hotel on Howe Street. And there was this large stairway which came down to the basement. And you could actually hear people pounding up and down this stairway over the air because it was right over the control room where the microphone was open most of the time. You'd hear something. Matter of fact, when I went to CJLR, Norm Grohman said, I went from doing Concert Under the Stars to Concert Under the Stairs. Anyway, back to Jack Webster. I heard him pounding down all these stairs. He had this tabloid newspaper in his hand, and he says, look at it. Look at it. It's the most horrible, muckraking filth of the worst possible kind, and I love it. Well, anyway, this was a tabloid called Flash that Ray Monroe, I believe he'd gone to Toronto to do this, but he started it up, and he had been sitting on this story at the province. He was a flamboyant reporter about this problem in the Vancouver police force, that some members had accepted bribes and had taken gifts from certain members of organized crime and from bootleggers and gamblers and people like this. And this is what this story alleged. So Jack could really see something developing from this. We didn't understand it, but he did. And there was a royal commission struck under R.H. Tupper, who was a Vancouver lawyer, had not been a judge. No, he'd been a lawyer, and he had been, I think, on the faculty at UBC, on the law faculty at UBC. So he had to run this Royal Commission, which started at the Vancouver courthouse. So it wasn't much of a hike from the courthouse for Jack Webster down to CJLR, which was on just down the street on Howe Street. Although when they moved the hearings to City Hall, it was a bit more of a hike. But Jack would go to this Royal Commission hearing every day with his notepad, and he would scribble down in shorthand all the proceedings, and then he would come back to CJLR and he would record it. He would go on the air and say, and this is the 20th day of the proceedings from the Royal Commission investigating bribery, graft, and corruption in Vancouver's police force. And on the stand today was Detective Sergeant Glenn Leatherdale. And today's testimony went like this. According to my shorthand notes, Tupper, now Detective Sergeant Leatherdale, where were you on the night of June 31st, 1950? Leatherdale, June has only 30 days. And have you lived in Vancouver all your life, Sergeant Leatherdale? Not yet. Well, you get the idea.
You do a great Webster.
Well, I had to ride the tapes all the time, which is another story. Jack would come down to the studio every night, well, about 5 o'clock maybe after the hearing was finished. Art Lehowski, the recording engineer, would put one of these big reel-to-reel tapes on. For the young people listening to this, that's what we had in those days, was reel-to-reel tapes, which was a step above the acetate discs that we used to record everything on. The problem with the discs was you couldn't edit them, and tape you could edit. So these tapes were, I think they were 12-inch reels. They were huge monsters because you get an hour on them. The smaller ones, the 7-inch, 10-inch reels, you could only get a half an hour on. So Art would tape this for Jack, just similar to the thing I just did for you. And he would spend about 3/4 of an hour, maybe an hour, sometimes 2 hours, depending on how lengthy the proceedings were that day. Then whoever was on in the evening would have to play this thing at 10:15. I think it was 10:15. Right after the 10 o'clock news. We had a big 15 minutes of news at 10 o'clock in those days. That was a big tradition in radio. Everybody, even if there wasn't any news, no matter what. So anyway, then somebody else read the news, I think, and I'd do a commercial and give the station break, bring in the tape. And Webster came on and said, "And here are the proceedings for January 15th, 1955. The only problem was it was January 16th, and I had grabbed the wrong tape and put on the tape from the night before. Boy, were people mad. Our switchboard lit up like a Christmas tree, as the saying goes. For the young people listening to this, offices used to have switchboards. The operator of the switchboard plugged in various phone lines to connect people with people who had phoned in, except actually, the switchboard didn't light up like a Christmas tree. It had red and green lights on it, but the switchboard operator went home at 10.
And jacked everything into the control room, I think, was basically what happened.
That's right. So our phones were ringing off the hook. That's another phrase of old technology that's still with us. People still use that phrase. I think it comes from the days about 70 years ago, when a phone receiver and a phone mouthpiece were separate. And the receiver hung on a hook, literally a hook. And when you took it off the hook, that connected the phone. And I don't know, I never saw this happen, but perhaps at some point the phones were ringing so long and loud that it caused vibration and jiggled the receiver off the hook. I don't know. But that's, and there's another phrase you hear all the time. I heard it just recently describing a news conference. Amid popping of flash bulbs, back to the phones ringing off the hook. And people were irate.
A lot of them probably thought this was live, though. So they were.
That's the other thing. Destroyed the illusion that Jack was there slaving till all hours of the night reporting the police.
When he was probably in the bar having a couple of scotches.
Could be. So I went to pieces. I think I was over in the corner assuming the fetal position or something. I couldn't do anything. Good old Bruno Simili, who wasn't even on duty. He was in early because although he did the all-night show, he also did the sports at 11 o'clock. He had to go on the air and say, "I'm sorry, this recording was played in error, and here is the correct one."
So you managed to get the tape down while he was doing this and put the proper one up.
But everybody thought Bruno had... the problem was the old tape shouldn't have been left beside the correct one. It should have been out of there. And I didn't have time, I guess, to check the date, although I should have. I never lived that down. The next day I saw Jack, and he looks at me and says, "I died 1,000 deaths last night."
You were doing the show then and running Jack's tapes.
Yeah. The other thing I did at CJOR was town meeting in Canada. One had to announce this, and one had a dual role with town meeting in Canada. Town meeting in Canada, and I had a conversation a few years ago with Senator Ray Perot, who was at a baseball meeting that I was at. We were talking about town meeting in Canada because he was one of the original announcers on town meeting when he was sports director at CJOR. And after he went into the ad agency business, he still came back and filled in for Arthur R. Helps, who was the creator and the moderator of town meeting in Canada. He would fill in as host, and we were discussing it. And he said, you know, that was a marvelous show. It discussed all the major issues of the day. It was syndicated right across Canada. It wasn't just at CJLR. We sent tapes all across to various radio stations. It garnered a huge number of awards. But being an announcer on the thing was a bit comical, even though it was a very serious show. One had to play the town crier at the beginning of the thing and then introduce the organizer and moderator of town meeting in Canada. So one had, first of all, to stand at the far end of the stage. The mic was in the center. It was a big overhead senior velocity mic. And you went over to one end of the stage and said, town meeting in Canada, town meeting in Canada, town meeting in Canada, here Angus McGuinness, Don Landscale, Ira Monson, debate should Canada and the U.S. have a customs union, come to town meeting in Canada. Then you had to rush back to the microphone and do a very crisp introduction about how in days of old the herald's call and the sound of the crier's bell summoned together a meeting of the people and the princes, the Witenagemote of England. And
you obviously done this so many times it's embedded in your mind.
It won't leave. So anyway, this very crisp introduction about how this was the modern Witenagemote, whatever that was, and that we were here to debate this topic, and again, you repeated the names of the speakers and introduced Arthur R. Helps, who was the moderator. You didn't do much for about the first half hour of the show because it was the people speaking on the subject, but then in the last half hour, you had to go down in the audience with a hand mic and get questions from the audience. Which was kind of a job in itself. People would try to wrestle the microphone out of your hand. And there were some regulars who were there every night, and it didn't matter what the subject was. They had, I remember it was an old Scottish gentleman was there all the time, and his question was always, how does it benefit the worker? And it didn't matter what the topic was. Could have been comedy on the radio or something like that. It mightn't be a serious public affairs or political question, but that was always his question. It was fun.
Who are some of the people you were working with there other than the ones you've mentioned? Can you think of...
Besides Bruno, there was Bob Gillies. He had left Concert Under the Stars and gone to Concert Under the Stairs like me. There was Barry Clark, Art Hives, and the old regular. Lloyd Houle was the chief announcer. There were the old regulars like Dorwin Beard and Ross Mortimer, and Billy Brown Jr. had taken over as the morning man. Yeah, some of the greats. Art Hives and I were fired from CJLR on the same day.
And what happened there?
Staff cut, they said.
See ya.
Yeah.
Was there any severance pay back then or any notice or anything? It's just show you the door?
Well, I think there was a notice. I think we had 2 weeks' notice or something. Oh. And Art Hives said, you know, I've been waiting from a sign from above. I've been waiting for a sign from above to tell me what I should do. So I'm going back to, I'm going to theology school. His father had been the principal at the mission school. So he was familiar with the Anglican Church. So he went back to theology school and became an Anglican priest. And you may have heard some of his programs starting out, I'm Art Hives, I'm a priest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you're out the door at WS.
at CJOR.
Or at CJOR, and you, of course, this is totally unexpected.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I always thought I was kind of superfluous.
Obviously, you needed a job, so what happened then?
Well, I phoned John Ansel at CKWX.
The man who helped train you and hired you?
Yeah, and I said, I explained what the situation was at CJOR, and he said, well, you know, we've just moved into great new studios at 1275 Burrard Street.
That was a beautiful building.
Yeah, it isn't there anymore.
No, gone. There's a condo.
Yeah, and they had a beautiful mosaic, which was done by B.C. Binning. And, I understand that's at UBC somewhere now. Red Robinson was saying that he and somebody else rescued it. They were just going to destroy it. Somehow they got it peeled off the wall, and It's out at UBC, but I don't know where it is, or, and I've never seen it. But yeah, he said that it was the Department of Fine Arts that took it, but where exactly it is physically.
So WX, you get the call?
And back to doing Concert Under the Stars. The reason being that they had, after I left, they had gone off the air all night again, and they were going to go to 50,000 watts sometime in 1956, I believe. And so they thought it'd be good to have the all-night show going again. So there I was, back at my old job.
But in a new building.
In a new building.
New equipment. State-of-the-art stuff for the day.
Yeah.
And that was a longer stay this time.
That was a longer stay. See what happened when I was there. Well, Red Robinson came over from CJOR. Bill Davis was hired as the morning man. He had been at the station in Bathurst, New Brunswick, although I think he was from Toronto originally. And he was another in the revolving door of morning men that they had. They had everybody. They had Barney Potts, Ron Robinson, forget who, and Bill Davis, and several others I'll get to later. So anyway, when Red came over, Dave McCormick likes to say Red was on late at night. He was on 11 to 1, and then I came on, did Concert Under the Stars. Dave McCormick likes to say Red played Chuck Berry, and then I went on and played Chuck Kowski. I'm glad I blamed that on Dave McCormick. Now, Dave's another one who was at the UBC Radio Society. Dave would often come and visit me. He was doing the late show at CFUN, and I guess signed off at midnight, and he'd come over and visit me in those days, and we'd talk about radio. He always had a keen sense of programming in those days, and had some critical comments to make about the way different stations were programming at that time, and very astute.
So this goes on for how long? You're doing the Concert Under the Stars.
Concert Under the Stars went on right through Red's era. The station still had not really come to grips with what it should do. Hiring Red was a good thing, and that upped the ratings at that time slot. But they had been for some time flirting with the idea of Formula Radio Top 40. John Ansel and Sam Ross, I think it was in 1957, had gone down to the States, to Minneapolis, St. Paul, listened to a station called WDGY, which had been started by Todd Storrs. And that, to my knowledge, was the first of the Top 40 radio stations. And they brought back these tapes, and we were just amazed at the sound. And they tried to implement it at CKWX, but they really didn't go all the way with it. And at that point, it didn't work that well. And then I think Red came over, and that jazzed it up a bit. And then when Red left, and I think maybe apart from the fact that Portland, Oregon was attractive and making him good offers, I think one of the reasons he left was he could see that we were going to Top 40 radio, the station would sound like his show all the time. And so that may be another reason that he decided it was good to leave. So anyway, we implemented something called the Westinghouse format, which had been adopted by CKEY in Toronto. And John Ansel went there and talked to CKEY and brought back some tapes and said, I think this is the way we're going to go. It was a little like the Storrs format, but a bit more subdued. It wasn't quite as frantic as the Storrs format had been. Also, he brought back some one-liner slogans that we were supposed to use. Unfortunately, some of them rhymed with CKEY, so you got things like, the accurate list of the songs that you buy played day to night on CKWX. So there I was doing the all-night show, but now instead of Concert Under the Stars, it was Top 40. I think maybe we got more listeners as a result of it. Again, no audience measurements. But we got some sponsors. They'd never been successful at selling Concert Under the Stars. And we got some sponsors and seemed to get some good reaction and sales for the sponsors. So I think that worked a little better. They insisted at one point, CKWX used to broadcast from the PNE regularly every year. They had a pagoda there, broadcast from that. It was a glassed-in thing with a stage outside where you could do some performances. And one night they decided that I should do the all-night show from there, even though the fair was closed. Could never figure out that logic. But there I was doing the all-night show, playing the top 40 stuff, all the hits, to nobody. And all of a sudden I heard this rumbling sound. There was a whole bunch of bikers coming in the gates. The gates were open at that time. It was about 3 in the morning. Huge bikers with black leather jackets and studs, tough-looking guys. And they said to me, I could hear them from outside, they said, play Rebel Rouser. I don't know if you remember Rebel Rouser with Duane Eddy. So I thought, oh, geez, if I don't play this, I'm in trouble. And I happened to have it because all the hits were there on the little rack. There were 45s in those days in the little rack. So I got Rebel Rouser, I put it on the turntable and played it. They were grooving around, enjoying it and stuff. And I said, after it was over, thank you very much. And they left. So I survived.
Your employment at WX, if my resume is correct, lasted until 1960.
Jesus,
or thereabouts.
Did it last that long? Yeah. I finally got off all night. I was doing, they had imaginative titles for all the shows in those days. I did the Ross Crane Show. And I also was filling in for people. It was 1959 at this point. When I did the all-night show, Nick Sands succeeded me doing the Nick Sands show. I was also filling in for some people who were off on vacation. And also, 59 was the year that I got married. My wife and I just celebrated our 50th last September.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So we had a nice honeymoon. We went to New York City on our honeymoon, which was a big deal, and enjoyed it. It was fall and autumn in New York, as the everything that the song says. And we came back, and we were in a new apartment in the West End on Burnaby Street. I had to get up the next morning and fill in for Jim Robson, who was the latest in the revolving door of morning men on the station. He was better doing sports, of course. He was the sports director after Bill Stevenson left. And he went on to a great sports career, of course, but it was, he had such an infectious sense of humor, they decided that they should make him the morning man, which doesn't always work. There are some guys, as you know, who are very dull in person, and they get on the air, and they are hilarious. And there are other guys who are just, they break you up all the time when you see them in person. They get on the air, they're terrible. Why this is, I don't know. Somebody should do a research. And Jim was a great sports reporter, of course, which is hard to do, especially play-by-play. As a morning man, he just didn't work. I think it was because there were a lot of restrictions put on him. He really couldn't just cut loose and be himself. And I remember one time he got into trouble because this was a time the Edsel had come out and Ford was really pushing this and they thought it was going to be the greatest thing. Jim said, you know what an Edsel is? An Edsel is a Buick sucking a Lenneman. Which is funny, but...
some of the sponsors may not have appreciated
it. The Edsel dealers did not appreciate this. So there were things like that that went on. Anyway, back to my filling in for Jim. And it was October, I think it was around October 15th of 19... Where are we now?
Around 16?
1959.
59?
Yeah, the year I was married. And we were just back from our honeymoon, and I went to bed early. Because I had to get up and be on the air at 6 in the morning. Fortunately, I had got an apartment that was close to CKWX. It was about 4 or 5 blocks along Burnaby Street to CKWX on Burrard Street. And so we're just turning in, and Kathleen, my wife, says to me, you know, there's an awful lot of ambulances activity outside. You should go out and see what's happening. No, I have to be up early. This is the West End. There's something happens here. There's a murder here every night. Don't worry about it. It's nothing. So get up the next morning, and I walk into CKWX, and Nick Sands, the all-night man, is there. And he says, boy, I've had a busy night. I've had every radio station in North America calling me for reports. I said, why? He said, Errol Flynn died last night. Flynn had died 2 doors down from where I was living. You know, I could have grabbed a tape machine, a portable tape machine, and got an exclusive. Didn't do it. Mm-hmm. It shows you how I never made a newsman and never will. Yeah, Errol Flynn had to have a shot from Grant Gould, who was Glenn Gould's cousin, I understand, the pianist, but he was a local doctor at the time, and that was his apartment on Burnaby Street. And Flynn had to have the shot, so we went to see him and gave him the shot, but it didn't work. Flynn was pronounced dead in a hospital. And this was 1959. So into 1960, yet again, CKWX is trying for a morning man. So they hired a guy who had been on Kobe, K-O-B-Y, in San Francisco, named Clyde Hatton. Ironically enough, he had been turfed out because the union said they had to, if they were cutting staff, they had to cut the most junior man. And so he was out of there. So he, on spec, applied to CKWX because I think he'd got mail from people in Vancouver who used to hear him on Kobe. And CKWX hired him. John Ansel said, you know, Clyde Hatton is awfully close to Hutton, who was going to be his biggest competitor and the guy he was trying to shoot down. So let's call him Buddy Clyde. He often uses this nickname. So we'll call him Buddy Clyde. So they hired Buddy Clyde as the morning man. I don't know whether he was successful or not because I left soon and it wasn't my idea. Because they hired Clyde at quite a high salary, they didn't need me anymore. So after that long time that you said at CKWX, I was told I wasn't needed anymore. So for some of the young people might be listening to this and that have been fired, and I understand this has happened at quite a few radio stations in Vancouver recently, take heart. I went east. Bob Gillies had already gone to CFCF. CFCF stood for Canada's First, Canada's Finest. It was started by Marconi himself, and it was the first station in North America to go on the air with regular programming. KDKA Pittsburgh was the first, but they weren't on the air all the time. CFCF was. Anyway, Bob Gillies had gone there to be morning man after Gord Sinclair Jr., who had been the morning man there for a century. He was the Bob Hutton of Montreal English. He left to start his own radio station up on the lakeshore, and for whom I went to work later, as it happened. Bob was doing the morning show, and the program manager was Laurie Irving, who had been at CKWX and remembered me. And he was actually one of the guys who taught the course back at the Radio Society. Mm. Yeah. So I went east, went to see Laurie, and Laurie said, well, we have an opening here. And he played my tape, my audition tape that I had done for the manager. And he came back, he said, you're hired. So I came back to Vancouver, packed everything up. My new wife, most of our belongings, put the rest in storage and headed for Montreal.
And what was your job there at CFCF?
Well, first I was working evenings, and then I got on to daytime. I followed Bob Gillies, and we had kind of a two-act going at the time. Then an afternoon show where I interviewed a lot of celebrities. And I also did a TV show, CFCF TV, had started at that point, so I did a game show, which was on opposite reruns of I Love Lucy.
Then you, as you said, you worked for Gordon Sinclair Jr. at CFOX briefly. Mm-hmm. And were they playing rock when you went over there?
No, they had not gone to rock. They finally went to country. I knew I was leaving at the time because while I was at CFCF and also at CFOX, I had decided to continue my education. And I went back to school, went to McGill University, and got a BCom degree while working in radio. I do not like country music much. The station went country, and I went along with it because I knew I was leaving. I'd been accepted at Columbia University at that point, and I thought, why not? So for a couple of years, while I was at McGill and able to finance tuition and things, books and things like that, I played country music. But not willingly.
That touches briefly on the Montreal radio, but then you said something very prophetic early on in our talk about radio being frightened about television.
Oh,
and
it
you,
was then,
And
yes.
You decided at 1965 or 66 to make the switch and go over to what we used to call in radio the enemy. And you started working for television doing various things for the next several decades.
Yeah, but behind the scenes.
Leah, you were one of the guys who was pulling the strings doing research, doing marketing, mm-hmm. doing numerous things for a very long time for some very high-profile people. CBS was one.
Yeah, CBS Television Network. I went to work for them after I left Columbia in what was known as the Market Development Department. What I did really was analyze audience data and then write sales promotion brochures. And there were some great shows on CBS in those days. There was the Carol Burnett Show. There was the Beverly Hillbillies, Gomer Pyle, USMC, Andy Griffith Show, Andy of Mayberry.
And then in 1969, you left CBS and went to CTV.
Yeah.
In Toronto.
Yeah, we'd had enough of New York. Lived in New York for 5 years. No, 4 years. 4 years. And the high crime situation was pretty grim. And I wasn't really climbing the ladder at CBS. I was still in the same job I'd been. So we decided head back to safe old Canada and Toronto. Got this job as the marketing research guy at CTV. Canadians were not that, although they had to fulfill their Canadian content obligations, they weren't that creative, I didn't think, on doing new shows. They happened to get a show that was successful. They stayed with it for a long time.
That continued till 1971, but you've had a lot of other things going on in your life. Let's say semi-retired, you're doing reading?
Yeah, that's volunteer work. That's at the Crane Resource Center. Charles Crane, actually, was an interesting person. He was a student at UBC, although he was deaf and blind. He was known as Canada's Helen Keller, and he managed to get a degree from UBC despite his difficulties. And when he graduated, he donated all the materials that he had used, I guess some Braille things and various other things, to the university as an inspiration to make more things available to students who had this problem. And I realized that I had met this person when I didn't know who he was when I went to read first at the Resource Center, but they told me the story about this guy that I just told to you. And something suddenly clicked. My mother and I went up to a place called Lake Lucille in the Garibaldi area one summer for a couple of weeks. And we went up on the railroad, the old PGE railroad, which went from Squamish in those days up through Garibaldi, what is now Whistler, Alta Lake. And it didn't go quite up to Prince George in those days. I think it finished at Quesnel or somewhere like that. But just south of the Garibaldi stop on the PGE was a resort called Crane's Lodge, C-R-A-N-E. My name's C-R-A-I-N. We weren't related. This lady ran Crane's Lodge, Mrs. Crane. Her son was Charles. And I remember meeting him then and thinking what an amazing person he was, that he could not see, could not hear, yet he could walk around the place. I remember he used to walk around with a child on his back, and the child would hit him on either shoulder to tell him which way to turn. He would be sitting there, he'd light his own pipe, the dog would come into the room, and somehow he knew the dog was there, sense of smell, I guess, or something. He'd reach down to pat the dog.
Well, so you're doing reading, recording...
At
what?
The Crane Resource Center. I just go once a week.
And is it books?
They can give me anything. They can give me law or business, which was my field. I graduated in an MBA from Columbia, and I taught business management.
That's another one we didn't touch on. I know you taught at one of the same schools that I was teaching at in Toronto, Seneca.
Seneca?
Yeah.
Oh.
Another thing I wanted to ask you, what in your broadcasting career, which was in the last century, in the first half of the last century mostly, favorite moment?
The highlight for me was interviewing Kim Novak. How about that?
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, I always had a crush on. That was when I was at CFOX, I think. I was at CFOX. And we got the word that she was coming through Montreal. She was flying to London to make a movie. And she was going to be between planes for quite a while. So we were all ushered into the VIP lounge at Dorval Airport, now Pierre Trudeau Airport. She was there, and she was such a gracious, friendly person. I mean, here is all us old hacks going there to interview this glamorous star, and you know, it's between planes, for heaven's sakes. She must have been tired, had just been, I believe, through a series of forest fires in California that burned the roof of her house. Things had not been good. She was just a lovely person, beautiful. That was the most thrilling moment.
Does Ross Crane listen to any radio these days?
Oh, yeah. I listen to radio all the time. I listen to News 1130 because I like to get local news. You can't get it on TV. Only at certain times can you get local news on TV. And News 1130, it's there all the time. I listen to KPLU in Washington State a lot, Pacific Lutheran University's radio. Well, I'm a jazz fan, so I love it. What else? CBC, sometimes. CBC French has a good job.
What about local radio other than that? Do you think radio still has a future? Can it rescue itself from the doldrums it's in these days?
AM radio, I don't know. AM radio seems to be on the skids. So many stations have gone dark.
The reception problems are enormous.
Yeah.
But the FMs have all turned into jukeboxes with no news, no programming, just music, music, music.
I think FM probably still has a future. It isn't too varied in this market. I don't know if it's strictly radio that is the problem. The whole broadcast industry seems to be done in by the internet. I think that they probably need to diversify a bit more, give us more variety on FM radio. But then again, you look at a station like King FM in Seattle, which has been classical music all day, all night.
They're still there.
They're still there, but they're going to listener-sponsored in a year.
Which is probably one way to do it, especially for a niche format such as classical.
So,
and the same with jazz.
So maybe this is the answer. We go to more and more of listener-sponsored radio so that you can get a variety of stuff like jazz or like music from the 1940s. Which you don't hear much anymore.
Well, you can find that on the internet. There's some great 30s and 40s stations on the internet, which I enjoy tremendously.
KUOW at the University of Washington has a show like that on Saturday nights with Amanda Wild. I don't know if you've heard it. It's called The Swing Years and Beyond. And it's very good because you get some of the old stuff. And not just 50s. They go back earlier than that.
Ross Crane, this has been delightful. Thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure.